Hello, and welcome to the Project Good podcast. I'm your host, Anne-Marie Hilton. Project Good is a social impact podcast interviewing experts and advocates about the pressing problems that we face globally and hearing how they suggest we move forward in the future. The Project Good podcast is brought to you by Project Good Work. The goal of this podcast is to inspire people or organizations to develop a mindset that can move others to positive action regarding the complex social issues facing people and the planet. For April, we're focusing on developing our consciousness. Developing consciousness is a complex and multifaceted topic that spans various fields, including philosophy, psychology, neuroscience, and spirituality. It involves the exploration of self-awareness, understanding one's thoughts and emotions, and cultivating a deeper understanding of the nature of existence. Consciousness is a capacity for individuals to deal with reality. The more complex the reality, the more need for a conscious approach. The purpose of consciousness at an operational level is to ensure that the difference between what an individual thinks or says about reality and the real facts is minimal. In today's world, reality is being questioned every day. As a society, we need to face the ever-growing list of problems head-on if we want to make change by understanding the many factors that have contributed to the issues and realizing that a one-size-fits-all approach will no longer work as the world has changed. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Karina Grace, the author of the book, The Weaver's Way. The Weaver's Way provides a blueprint for shaping change that harnesses our deep inner instinct for connection and caring. Within that blueprint lies a new story for shaping change, one built on understanding of the world as an interdependent and interconnected entity. It makes the privilege of shaping change as inclusive and accessible as the old way was exclusive and elite. Let's get into the interview. First, let me introduce our guest, Karina Grace. She's a social entrepreneur, engineer, author, and sustainability leader with 15 years building and strengthening social impact organizations. Additionally, she has spent over 10 years living and working with disenfranchised, economically marginalized communities on the front lines of climate change and has solidified a personal commitment to ensuring justice and equality for people and the planet, a commitment that shapes her work at all levels. Karina feels that we are in a decisive moment in human history, one that is asking us to both turn and face the harsh truths of our past, as well as roll up our sleeves to begin the work of shaping a better future together. Welcome, Karina.
Thank you. And it's just so lovely to be here. I love what you're doing at Project Good Work and particularly this podcast. So I'm honored to be here to talk with you today and happy 2024.
Thank you. I'm honored to talk to you as well. You know, you have such a beautiful soul. So that's, you know, one of the things that continuously attracts me because in this world that we are facing, finding people who have, I would say, I guess for lack of a better term, a real heart is becoming hard to find. And people who, don't just feel for themselves, but they feel for humanity and they see each individual and they really want, a better experience for each person. So that's why I'm so excited to talk to you because your heart truly just, I even feel it. I know we're like in the same room, but I can just feel it through the voice. It gives me chills. Before we get into the questions, I always like to ask a little bit of how somebody became who they became. So why did you, turn into, being an advocate for humanity?
Wow. Well, look, I don't know that I turned into it. If nothing else, I was probably just fortunate along the way to be guided. But one of the things I always think about is from early on, I was a very passionate advocate for the environment. And I always kind of think that I was like Greta Thunberg, but I just didn't have David Attenborough as my best friend. But I, quite young age, was out there. Even back when, it was global warming and kind of going to protests and marches when I was quite young. So it's always been there as a care for environment. And I guess I became an engineer and enjoyed learning, the engineering part of like how things work, but it wasn't working for me in terms of how things work in air conditioning and building and mechanics. And it was more the alchemy of human connection and how human systems work. And so I think that my journey took me from that curiosity of what does it take for us all to live collectively on this planet, and have the planet be able to sustain us, is what has been the big question that has driven me all along. And then just that activist heart that is agitating on the edge looking for the answer to that question, of which I haven't yet found.
Yes, well, you know, I like that you know, when you first started, that you had this engineering mind. Engineers tend obviously to think about everything in systems and how they work. That's interesting that you took that turn, but I understand. I understand how life works sometimes, just going and in a way, following the blueprint that everybody has, and then being able to be brave and step out of that and see how you can make a greater impact than just the standard.
Yeah.
So let's dive in a little bit and talk about this kind of, I guess, you know, it sounds a little bit like an esoteric topic, you know, developing consciousness. I know sometimes when, you know, you just say the consciousness word, people tune out. They're like, oh, you know, they think of outer space and the stars and everything of that matter. But, you know, but I really think that is, you know, the right word that we are facing, whether people want to, you know, name it something different, is that we are coming to a time that I feel that everybody needs to make what I'm calling the decision. Uh-huh. And so the decision, you know, is not about, you know, here in the U.S., we think all the time about political parties. It's become, you know, this versus, you know, them versus us, or you versus right, me, or everything like that. But it's much deeper than that. This is a thing that has to deal with each individual, and it has nothing to do with politics. You know, I'll say maybe government has an arm in it, but it's not, it's beyond that. It's an individual of, I would say, maybe a moral standpoint of, you know, choosing what is right or wrong, or, you know, are you going to take action and do the right thing when something horrible is presented to you? Because, you know, what we're seeing now is that why we become horrified is that we see that people, when presented with what we would think, or at least, I guess I shouldn't even speak for everyone because the minds have changed, but things that used to, let's say 20 years ago, like stir like people to go, ooh, now are just like, whatever, yeah. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess let's ask the big question first. Do you think people want change in the positive direction, I should say? Yeah.
Look, you've made me think talking about that consciousness. I often play with this concept, or not play the concept, but I'm curious. I feel like as a species, we've reached a point where maybe it's not, you know, we choose to have a level of consciousness, but it is time for a maturing as a species. And a maturing, and, you know, I was listening to a podcast the other day that was just talking about how in many indigenous cultures, there is, you have an identity as the custodian species of this planet. And it's, you know, I didn't grow up with that here where I grew up in Australia. And just this idea of how would we shift if we accepted the responsibility that I believe comes with a certain maturity of the custodian species of a planet and everything that's on it. And I know that when I pose that question to myself, I feel this kind of shifting inside and like a kind of just this realignment, and to me it's to do with just this level of maturity that we're being invited to step into as a species. And so, like, to come back to the question, do we need to change or do people want to change, I think you know, with as people, we're changing every day, right? Like that's just what life is. And I think one of the questions is what kind of change, in what time frame. And maybe more importantly, how we're being invited into that change. And, you know, one of the, as I said, I grew up really in that environmental movement in the 80s and the 90s. And I think one of the big mistakes we made in there was that the environmental movement went out and said, you naughty person, you bad person, you're destroying the environment, you're polluting, you must give up your car and give up their holidays and give up this other thing. And then, you know, we'll all live this very frugal life and then everything will be fine. That doesn't inspire anybody to change. And I actually think, you know, there's a shift now, and that's not so much the language, but I do think when we think about the change that we need to make as a global society, and particularly in the West, how we're inviting people to step into that, and how we are saying, actually, on the other side of this transformation, I believe there is a truly more beautiful place, a place where there is more connection, where there is less loneliness, where we are in relationship, where we have time and space to appreciate what's around us. So, yeah, do people want to change? Maybe not, but I do think we're capable of it, and I do think we're capable of leading people there if we are able to inspire them and guide them along a path.
Now, one of the things I think you, as I was listening to you talk, and you talked about, you know, being connection. And I think what I'm seeing, and I don't know, you can tell me if you've seen this too, there's it's kind of a yin-yang about connection right now in the society. Like, people are craving it because I think, you know, that's how we're built as humans, to be, you know, in community. But then there's also this, like, I need to be on my own. There's so many different, and what I mean by that is, like, there's so many different, I guess, in a way, like, paths that people are thinking about. So it used to be like, you know, we used to have like, okay, you know, this concept we could all understand. But now, so for instance, even this one, I'll take a simple one that people can answer or think about, like, even the concept of, you know, the world is round and not flat. Now we have even people that want to argue about everything because they're like, I haven't been to outer space, so I don't know if I want to agree. Right. And so, you know, I guess I want to ask the question, how do you think we got here that we now question everything? Not that we shouldn't have questioned, curiosity is great, but how do we get to the point that we have so many questions we, in a way, I think are stuck?
Well, I feel like there's actually a couple of parts to that question that are interesting to unpack in different directions. So one of the ones that I hear you say, we want to be connected, but then, like, we think really different, right? Some people think the earth is flat and some people think it's round, for example. I think one of the things that happens is, therefore, we cannot be in relationship. And that's where, and again, I think that what's interesting is that, I see a lot of this manifesting in the West, is that to be in relationship, we must be thinking and agreeing and completely aligned. And actually, like, that is not a healthy democracy. A healthy democracy has space for different ideas and different opinions and different viewpoints, but we're able to be in relationship despite those differences. And so one of the things I think is happening is that because we don't have this understanding of what the fundamental nature of interconnectedness is, and perhaps there we confuse it with connected or this relationship, which actually tends towards tribalism, because if you want everyone to think the same, you know, cult or a tribe, great place to be. But if you want to have diversity of opinion, it is, how can I be in relationship with you despite? And how do we create and allow for these places of tension and difference? And this is the second piece that I would add to that, is one of the things that I do think we're missing a lot, and particularly in a lot of our leadership that we're seeing in kind of political spaces, is the ability to deal with paradox. You know, and the ability to deal with paradox says there may be a space where both of those things are true. And as leaders, as folks wanting to work on change and to navigate this world, I think the ability to hold paradox is one of the fundamental skills that we need to cultivate more.
So this one, I believe that's the hardest thing, at least this is what I've seen through history, kind of like always makes me one of this, throw a book and run in the air, is that, because I always feel like it's that thing of acceptance, right? That word acceptance. Sure. And I feel like the word acceptance in a way is, it's great, but it's also been abused. So I don't know. Sometimes I'm just like, because it's like, I feel like we go to extremes and we never meet in the middle, which I believe the word itself means. which
except
is always
it means
ironic.
Meet in the middle.
I believe this is my interpretation is like except since we meet in the middle and you know because I usually visualize kind of everything and so you know it doesn't mean that you know I'm you know just see everything I can see you know maybe a little bit your way it doesn't mean that you know I am 100% on your side right because uh-huh. When you're in the middle you can't be completely on that side but it means that okay. I will take into account that you may look at something different and that's okay. But it doesn't seem to work that way in this society anymore. In fact, I think that people sort of like we were before we jumped in, this is goes to like, I guess, realities. People want to have... you know, a whole bunch of different alternative realities than maybe what's true.
Sure.
And, you know, I guess that's even like when I now even dive deeper, sorry, because this set me off into a little bit of a tangent in my mind, is that when we're developing consciousness and, you know, searching and kind of, you know, in that spacey realm of consciousness, we're looking for truth. And so in looking for truth in this society, I don't know, is this is, I guess this is kind of relativity. Now we're going to go into like, you know, is there a, I guess, do we have to come to like an agreement on what is going to be true in order for us to then, push aside, oh, this is a bad, that I'm going to use it. It's not exactly, I'm just going to say BS. I didn't say a bad word on my podcast, but to push it aside, because I think we are, you know, we're getting like distracted by all these crazy things, right? Like, oh, you know, it could be like, oh, so-and-so is now wearing yellow. Somebody is offended by yellow because da, 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 da. So-and-so said their new name is this, but they were, and everybody's like, you can't just rename yourself. Like these things are distractions. You know, I think having that we have to have a foundation of truth. And so we just discussed kind of how we got there, but how do we get back to a truth? Because I think it's like if we're all running around like, you know, chickens with our heads cut off, and then these problems are getting bigger and bigger because nobody essentially can focus. We need to have something that grounds us. So the only thing I can think that grounds us is we have to decide on the truth. So I don't know. What's your opinion?
Look, I think there's there's a couple of things as I listen to you. So I think grounding into one fundamental truth becomes pretty difficult unless maybe you're talking about religion, right? Like that's kind of the basis of some religions. And where I go to if I'm thinking about these things and I'm thinking about working with people with whom I have differences, I come back to values. So it's not like narrowing everything down to a single fundamental truth, but it's saying, can we build some commonality under which we share the same values? And I pretty much haven't yet really found anyone I've gone, wow, just values is not there, right? Most people will say, I value family, I care for family, you know, I want to protect and love look after these people that I love. Most people tend to value certain things that they can have in life if they can have, you know, a nice place to live. I mean, just, you know, there's a place where we can say we could connect on this and then how do we build from there? But I also hear in what you're saying a little bit of something else that's symptomatic of, I think, where we're at as a society. And I'll say particularly in the US. And I work in different kind of cultures and different countries. And so, you know, I have I think it's a gift that I can look at from the outside at these different societies and how they're playing out. And the US is definitely an interesting one. But I wrote about this a little while ago, and I was kind of playing with this idea that this battle that we're talking about between democracy and autocracy, when we talk about particularly, you know, the US versus China or the West versus China, I just had this moment of that actually, that is a battle that's going to be determined by how we as individuals show up in our most vulnerable moments. And part of that is to do with this idea that comes from the wise adult adaptive child framework from transactional analysis theory. that looks at how we respond in moments of great uncertainty and turbulence that we're facing right now. And this comes back to the maturing that we need to do as a society and as a civilization or as a species, is that if we haven't done this work of consciousness that you talk about, when things get hard, we go back to our adaptive child. And our adaptive child hijacks the neocortex. Like, that's what happens. We are no longer able to manage complex situations or nuanced relationships. And we become very rigid. We become reactive. We become perfectionistic, unforgiving. We are looking for someone to tell us what to do. Now, does that sound like anything that you're seeing reflected in society? I think it does, right? We are looking for the authoritarian leader that says, I have the answers and this is what you have to do. And I don't know that actually coming back to a single truth is going to get there, because I actually think this is your fundamental question about consciousness. We need to do the work so that when things are hard, we don't all fall back into our adaptive child and behave like children, but we can stay in our wise adult that is capable of strategic thinking, of decision making, of holding paradox and accessing multiple perspectives, etc. So that's that's my take on it.
Yes. I like how you are attributing, about how the society has to mature and grow. And, I think this is just my, not all my life, but a good amount of my life, I've lived in the U.S. And so this has always been my perception, is that perhaps if you have everything kind of handed to you, it's kind of like in families where you have the golden child, everything is handed to them, and then you have the other child that is told to go out there and work, and they have two different concepts of reality and also the things and the level that they can handle. And so, if you are everything given to you, the slightest thing, you can't find your mixing socks, could make you have a crying spell, right? But then you have the other strong child, and this is going to sound morbid, they lost a leg, but they're like, I'm going to go get a prosthetic and I'll move forward, right?
And, yeah, we get on with it.
Right. And the problems are so much, bigger, but they're just like, I can do it. So I know, you have your book, The Weaver's Way, that you talk about working with communities as, the seed for causing interconnection and then leading to this change. If you were going to give three main steps from, what you've learned through your work and through how you instruct people in The Weaver's Way, what would you say to people to get to where they need to be?
I wanted to talk about your example too, because you just made me think, The Weaver's Way fundamentally, I wanted to tell that story because I've worked with the folks on the margins, the folks that are living with this level of uncertainty, they're living with the impacts of climate change and all these other things every single day. And so when I hear your story, you're saying, you're talking back to me about resilience. Right? Like, one child is resilient and one, the sibling is not. And one of the things, as I was writing this book, I had a very real lived example, because my hometown in Australia was completely destroyed by 3 1-in-1,000-year floods. But so, I think that there is this veil of safety and security that we have in the West that is going to be ripped away if it hasn't already. And along with this sense of control we have. And so I think that the ability to be resilient, which is what I see from folks on the margins, that they have this, is something that we need to learn if we don't have it yet. And so really when I wrote this book, it was, there is so much wisdom, there is so much lived experience from these folks on the margins and from the way that they're leading. And how can I bring that into a story that maybe others of us that haven't lived that way could learn? And so to come back and answer your question, one of the, again, the engineer in me loves to put things on like 4 points of a compass or in, 3 bullet points. So tend to oversimplify, but one of the things that I use as kind of a mantra for shaping change is people, process, and place. And that comes back to this idea of relationships. But I guess one of the things when I think about is that fundamentally community is a web of interconnected relationships. Like that is what it is to me, whether it's your relationship with the earth, it's a relationship to the people around you. And so when we think about creating change and we think about how that happens, the question is, what is it that these people in this place need in a way that can restore our connections to ourselves, to each other, and to the earth, to a healthy state? Like that is the change that needs to happen wherever that is and whatever the scale, because community really can have, you know, we are a global community in many ways, but to take back people, process, place, these people in this place to restore our connections.
So what you've described is that it's not necessarily as kind of like what I said in the intro of like, it's not a one size fits all, but it does have the same processes I can't say the word today. And so, you know, and it could be, I guess, at a smaller level or a much larger level, depending, of course, you know, where you are and what the situation is. And so being able to, I guess, get everybody to, you know, see that, you know, I guess that they have to contribute. That's the other thing is like getting people, these are my thoughts, but getting people to realize that they have to contribute because we're getting to a point that you really, you can't just be a bystander anymore. It doesn't mean that you have to be like, you know, oh, I can give $1 billion to it because we don't all have $1 billion. But maybe you can be the encourager. And what that means is that you tell people like, okay, you know, we are experiencing, you know, the ground is no longer producing the same yield. This is actually a problem. Actually, I interviewed somebody about that, you know, we're like only 40 harvests away. So I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be old and fighting for an apple in the streets. it made me like, that's what I use for gym motivation. So got to get out there and stay in shape for it to get my apple later on. You know, and getting people to know that, okay, so maybe you're not the farmer and not the expert, but you can be like, okay, do more research or contact, a company that can give, advice about how to get more nutrients into the ground or just educate the people, like, you know, you don't do the slash and burn because, you know, it actually isn't helping us. So there's, you know, there's that, I guess, motivating people to contribute, because that's the other thing that I see. And, you know, like I'm in the U.S. And so, like I was saying, I would say that we are the child of the, you know, the sock makes us cry. So, you know, how do we get, but we're also the people just as a child, usually that is the golden child. Usually needs to take more than the other child. So how do we get people to know that, you know, they need to start contributing in whatever way that they possibly can, because, you know, they're part of this big moving wheel, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, look, I think a couple of things, and that, again, this is partly was my motivation for writing the book. And you know, I remember, I mean, I ran Ceres for 10 years, and whenever I would travel out of Guatemala and visit the US or come back to Australia, people, you know, I felt like people were kind of putting me on this pedestal. And there was this, you know, it was the time when language of being a change maker came out, which always seemed somewhat grandiose. And also, to be really honest, it's pretty inaccessible if you're just trying to get through life and pay the bills and pay your mortgage or whatever, you know, get the kids to school on time. And I really felt that we developed this concept of change where change was like the realm of, you know, leaders and politicians, and then maybe there was this new brand of social entrepreneurs and change makers. But for me, it was realizing exactly what you're saying, that we all need to be engaged in shaping change, every second of the day, and we can and we are. So when I wrote The Weaver's Way, it was really, I wanted to help just facilitate this shift in perspective when it comes to change that made what I call a privilege, because I do think it is a privilege to be shaping the future we want, that makes that, as you said in the intro, is as kind of inclusive and accessible as this old concept was very, what I felt was exclusive and elite. And so, you know, part of that is just understanding, I guess, that each and every one of us, in all of the decisions we make every day, whether it's where we're going to buy our coffee or where we buy our groceries or what bank we're using, are contributing to a future. Now, the question is that the future that we want to build? And so really the whole journey of this idea of becoming a weaver is to say, what does that look like? And so I always say we start by paying attention and bringing intentionality to some of the things that we do. And there's a very good friend of mine, his name is Professor Michael Gordon. He just published a new book called Do Good With Money that I love, that I was just looking through, because he takes something that's part of every day, which is money, and he shows you don't have to be a wealthy billionaire to do it, which again is often when I was running Ceres and I would meet my friends and they'd be like, well, I wish I had $1 million to give to you, right? But I don't, so I can't really do anything. And, you know, in the book, and he just takes something very simple, Do Good With Money, that shows as simple as where you spend the money or what credit card you use or, you know, those decisions can help to create change on these issues that you're talking about. You know, whether are you choosing to buy fair trade or are you choosing to buy local when it comes to food, or what kind of food systems are you supporting? And the other place Michael and I talked a lot while I was writing The Weaver's Way, he was one of my early editors and gave me a lot of feedback, was for us this idea of relationships that are central to our well-being and the well-being of society. And so, yeah, I think as anyone starts to get their head around, like, what can I do to shape change? To me, there's maybe the easiest way to summarize the problems we have right now is that in the West in particular, there's this mentality of disposable people, disposable planet. And every action, if we could question, is this me treating somebody as disposable or the planet as disposable, this resource? And as we can question that and start to question our actions, I think we start to create change in very simple ways that add up.
Now, and I'm just taking a moment to think, because
that's a lot.
well, it is a lot. And then, you know, the barrier I always think, and I don't, you know, and I don't know if it's, I guess you would say, in a way, home training, or I don't know if it's education, because people can choose, you know, where they want to, what they want to put in their mind and not put in their mind. But being able to, I guess, see individuals, like, I believe that's like one of the biggest barriers in why we're seeing some of these horrific things is that, you know, people don't see people as, you know, individuals and humans. I don't know, it's been like, as anybody that's, you know, read or watched any of the news, or even unfortunately maybe experienced some of these, you know, unprecedented situations, it seems like it is on a horrific trajectory of how people just you know, kind of, I guess you would say, next, and they just move on.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's, do you think that, this is, I'm going to just do kind of an aside, because I've been noticing this, it could just be my phone, but I've noticed, like, when I go to Google now and then the news pops up, it's all like flowery or things that like don't matter. And I don't know, it could just be my phone, but I hadn't spoken to somebody else. It's like when I, you know, open it up, you know, nothing against the movie Barbie, I didn't, you know, but it'll be like, oh, you know, how to get your Barbie pink, right? or, you know, yes, or, you know, so-and-so celebrities on their seventh marriage, right? And I feel like there's, and I started noticing this like some months ago, and I feel like there's a thing kind of to put like maybe a shield
in a way that there's a lot of stuff going on that, you know, that we really should be concerned about. Like, you know, like I said, nothing against Barbie Pink, but I've noticed that. I don't know if you noticed that at all. It could just be here.
I think Google knows me a lot better than to put Barbie Pink on my television. We might have to end our relationship. But, you know, it's not surprising. And I think that there's two things happening, right? So one is, if we go back to this idea of when, of kind of the transactional analysis, am I in my wise adult or my adaptive child? When your neocortex is hijacked and you get into fight or flight, one of the things we go to is distraction and addiction. Like, that is one of the like responses that we have when we are totally overwhelmed. And so that's really great for advertising companies. And so, again, I look at this and I look at people that are scrolling through TikTok or other things, right? And just thinking, like, that is actually a coping mechanism, because it is so challenging to me to imagine that my world is crumbling as the way I feel like my world is crumbling. So it is much easier to be distracted. And, you know, I write about this in the book, that there is really hard, like, how there is work to be done. And I'll take it back to your question of kind of raising consciousness or this, you know, level of maturity. How can I stand with eyes wide open and hold a broken heart every day, which is the work, and still remain open to the love and beauty in the world? And it is hard to choose to say, I'm going to bear witness, and in bearing witness, there will be pain and there will be a reckoning that I'm on this historical through line that has maybe caused some of this pain, and still be engaged. And that, to me, I think is some of the fundamental work, because if we do not, if we close and turn away and we scroll through TikTok, or we distract ourselves, or we, you know, addictions with work or drugs or whatever else it is, then we're not moving ahead, and we're not doing the work we have to do. So, like, I absolutely acknowledge that is a hard choice to make, but I think it is essential if we're going to find a solution to some of the challenges that you're saying and not turning up on the telephone.
I guess how, like, if we were just going to give people a baby step, because in my head, I see people who are this, like, freaking out, like, they're like, I can't do it. I can't, you know, like, they just, they're like, you know, it's just horrible. They, you know, children are, you know, getting, like, you know, bombed and killed. You know, floods are taking people away. Another earthquake just happened, you know, and people are just like, you know, I have to, like, run away. How can we take, I guess, a baby step? Would you say, like, only give yourself like 10 minutes of like news a day so that you don't like have a meltdown? Or I guess what's one simple practical step that people can start slowly working towards maturing?
Well, I think it's giving space to acknowledge all these things that exist, to acknowledge that pain and to acknowledge suffering and to acknowledge, I feel scared. I feel heartbroken. And I say this because, you know, as you were saying, I'm thinking about my friends who are parents, right? And it's hard to be a parent of small children in this day and age, especially working parents that are trying to juggle so many things that when I look at them from the outside, I'm like, how are you not just a huddle in the corner sobbing? You know, like, you're keeping so much together. And when I talk to my friends, the bottom line is, because we can't, because we're parenting and we can't fall apart. We just have to do what we have to do because that's life, and we, you know, we get on with it. And I almost feel there's, like, how do you take that attitude that says, I can acknowledge all these things are happening. I, as Karina, cannot fix all of them. I probably can't do very much to influence what's going on in the Middle East. I probably can't do very much to influence the US elections. But there are places where, as Karina, I can show up and I can influence change. And so partly it's to say, I can acknowledge those things are there, and I can acknowledge that there is suffering, and I feel grief and I feel loss. And to just, like, A, let that be part of the conversation. It doesn't mean that I have to fall apart and nobody's actually served by that. And then I can also be very intentional with where I invest my attention. My attention being my time, my money, my scrolling on my phone, and saying, okay, of all these things that are happening, this is the one place. And whatever that is, and normally what I find, because I work one-on-one with folks that are going on this kind of changing journey, is, what is the thing you're seeing around you that that's actually, so, you know, it starts with this, I'm actually really overwhelmed because I see all of this stuff. But normally it comes down to, well, actually what's really getting me is every day I walk down the road and I catch this bus and then I go to the city, but I have to walk past this really old man who's homeless and, you know, and he just seems really, whatever it is, he seems really upset. And I just wish that there was something to be done. And so you take that very personal experience and you take what's actually really hurting you on a day-to-day basis and say, what can I do here that was slightly different? Maybe you stop and say hello and acknowledge the person, and that's just the one thing that you do. Or maybe you see what's going on for people who are homeless in your neighborhood, whatever that is. But you pay attention to where you're getting called, and then you follow that. Yeah, that's, to go back to your question, made me to start. It is a roomy quote I'm thinking of. Is let yourself be silently drawn by the strange pull of what you really love. It will not lead you astray. So how do you listen to that?
Yes, you know what? You just gave me an epiphany that that the truth is what we're all dealing with is that we have been programmed. I don't know. I think it probably works maybe everywhere, maybe even in Antarctica too, is that we are programmed to be told to not feel our emotions. Because you talked about embracing grief.
Yeah.
Which is something that's not a slogan. It's not a tagline. Everybody's like, embrace grief. Like you don't see a t-shirt. But you know what? If you know, you don't see a t-shirt that says embrace grief, never,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Who needs to make one?
Right. But now you hit on something that if we had learned and got comfortable, that's what we're all experiencing. And that's why things are a mess. If we had all learned how to get comfortable with feeling and facing grief, then we would have been able to handle the other emotions, because the other emotions are not as horrible feeling, right? Like you don't really get mad about being happy. And even if you're angry, right, you sometimes secretly feel happy. Because I don't know, here, listen with me, because it depends on what you're angry about. You're like, I knew I was right. I knew, you know. So you're not, you know, so you're even the anger feeling is not as horrific to deal with as that grief, right? So all the other emotions you can deal with, but that grief, no, everybody will run 10 miles. They don't even want to see the word.
And I, you know, I have my one of my nieces is, I mean, she's 11 or 12 now, but when she was younger, I mean, she was very involved from, again, she grew up in our family, so very involved in the climate movement, and she felt it, and she would express it, and the teachers at school would be, oh, she's such a sensitive, you know, she's a little bit too sensitive around things. And I, you know, I just thought, what child, knowing what's going on in the world, would, like, isn't grief a normal way to feel? And actually, if we could just acknowledge it and be there, then it becomes the fuel for, like, driving what we would do going forward. And it's actually, as you say, like, when it's when we're called out as being too sensitive, and then we say what's normal is actually you can bear witness to whatever it is, the forest you played in not being there anymore, to having more bare supermarket shelves, whatever those things are, to witnessing these things on the news, it's like horrific things that are taking place around the world, and not feel something, like, isn't that the crazy thing? and yet we're somehow normalized that not feeling anything is normal, and that those that do respond are called oversensitive.
Yes, but yeah, and then, you know, so that just you gave me such deep insight, because I was like, that's what's wrong, then, you know. And because you don't know how to handle grief, then, you know, you get into that, you know, running around in circles, looking at, you know, whatever on scrolling.
Busy work.
Because you just feel this, like, you can't even describe the feeling, because you just like, I can't feel it.
Yeah.
and that goes to everything that you've been saying about maturity, because a maturity, as I learned a lot last year, is really about learning how to deal with your emotions and and still, you know, moving forward to what you need to do. And so the hardest one, of course, is grief. So yeah, you hit on something big right there.
Excellent.
Now I just have a couple more questions for you. So I guess, one is a fun one. I always like to hear, stories. What has been the most remarkable thing that you've learned, since, you know, starting your, kind of conscious approach to life?
You know, I think that the thing that I discovered, was, working with a very dear friend who's a Sutuhil Maya, and she was the first young Indigenous woman that I started working with when I was working in Central America. And we started doing this kind of sustainability leadership work together. And I had come from as an engineering, I had worked in for an investment bank, very pragmatic attitude. And so I came in with like a very westernized view of, you know, time is money and, you know, time is limited, and this very kind of linear concept of time. And I remember sitting with her once, and so I was kind of building the organization and she was working with it, and I was not quite the AD because it wasn't that formal, but that's where it was. And I would get very frustrated about planning of meetings and timelines and deadlines and all those kind of things. And she turned to me and she was like, "So time is money and we're hanging out as friends. Have you commodified our friendship?" And it's every time I think about it to this day, I almost want to fall off my chair. But it was this, I didn't know the word to respond. I was just like, have I? I think my response was, I guess I have, you know, and I'm thinking, do I have time to hang out with you now? Do we have time to do this? And it just began this kind of unraveling for me and seeing into how there is, in the Western world, we commodified everything as part of the way we do our economy. We commodified relationships, we commodified nature, you know, and in that we moved everything from what was these, again, interconnected trust-based relationships and community to everything as transactional. And so that was the learning, both in terms of, so many things of now I question, like, is this commodified? So time to me, I try not to say time as money and I try not to think of time as a linear quality because I have learned from the Indigenous communities I work with that time is more slushy and circular and not at all linear. I have tried to move most things from what I do from transactional to trust-based in terms of the work that I do. And it's just it's a constant unlearning that I find myself doing. And interestingly, now I've just recently moved back to Australia and I'm finding myself hard up against that paradigm once more of everything is commodified and I need to fit my life into this. And so I'd say it's a constant unlearning, but it's been something that I never stopped getting insights from.
I like how you have that, like there's a concept of time, that the time is kind of, it just continues, it's a continuous. It reminds me of a relationship of like when you have a very good friend and you live, you know, in different countries. And so you don't get to see each other the same as you did when you were maybe growing up or something. When you do see each other and meet for a tea or coffee, it feels like you were just together the other day. And so, you know, that's beautiful because that is hard to find.
It is.
That, you know, that the time seems to continue and that it is just that we're just all part of like a process of like growing, but coming back to like, I guess even like, to touch base, that it's bigger than like, we just have to get these tasks done.
Exactly. And it's more rewarding when it is that way as well, you know? Yeah. So then we can slide along that scale to, and that's like, because it's a trust-based relationship, right? It's not these kind of interesting transactions that things have become. Yeah.
Now, my last question for you is, I was like playing around a little bit. I guess if you were going to summarize what you hope 2024 brings to people, because when I looked up the year just for fun, supposedly 2024 is supposed to be a year about like a reflection, renewal. So I guess, how would you suggest that they start tackling that and make this like an awesome 2024?
Sure. You know, I don't know about you, but I have definitely started this year feeling like what I need and what the world needs, first of all, is a big collective inhale and a long collective exhale. And I keep trying to remind myself to do that every day. I'm not great at it. But part of that is actually when we do that, we are working to calm our parasympathetic nervous system. And so one thing I just feel is that we're on edge. And so just grounding ourselves. And then, you know, I'll say it all the time, the world needs weavers. The world needs people like you that are doing this work, and probably many of those listening to this podcast. And you know, weavers are those folks that are doing what they can to strengthen the social fabric. They are holding these relationships and working to bring us together when there are these incredible forces trying to tear us asunder. I think that's going to be essential for many of the different countries around the world that are going through elections this year. And weavers who can do the work of tending and mending and repairing these, both the fraying edges of the fabric of society, but also the relationships within it. Because I think I was doing a thought experiment on this before. Our throwaway commodified society actually doesn't value that which is repaired and reused as much as we used to 50, 70, 100 years ago. And so even valuing that work of those who are, whether it's as a metaphor or it's the very practical, how do we value that has been repaired and make that as a fundamental part of the work that we're doing?
I love that. I was picturing like a frayed tapestry as you were talking, and now it made me even understand deeper. I understood, you know, why you named your book The Weaver's Way, but that, you know, encompassed it even more, understanding how you took it from, you know, something that is been tattered and how we are, you know, working to build it back to its beauty. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah.
I really, really, really enjoyed our conversation. And I love talking to you because I just feel your energy. I said, even if you're not in the room, I love talking to you. So thank you, Karina, for your time and insight. If you'd like to know more about Karina Grace, go to karinagrace.com. If you have a passion for an unserved community, a social justice problem, or simply want to change minds, contact Project Good Work at projectgood.org to start your project of change today. It's that time again. The Changemaker Conference is happening May 23rd, 2024. Register now at changemakerconference.com. Subscribe to our mailing list at projectgood.org/subscribe to get our episodes and blog articles sent to you each month, plus get a 10% discount on any project you start on projectgood.org. To our listeners, thanks for tuning in to Project Good, where we're focused on what matters.